Welcome everyone who's either watching this live or listening to the recording. This is the second quarter of 2012 edition of Mises Academy class, Principles of Economics, and this is the first office hours session. Let me just explain what this thing is, because there's some people who have never taken one of my classes before. If you have been to college or are a college student right now, you know that there's a thing called office hours. And it's a totally optional thing where the professor will be in his office for a certain period of time. And the idea is that's when you can swing by and, you know, talk about the material for the course that you're going over, or just it's sort of more open-ended. And that's kind of what we're doing here. So if you have questions about the class, in particular the material we just covered in the previous Wednesday's lecture, then by all means we can discuss that here, but more generally. So usually these things pretty quickly deviate from the material of the class itself, and they're pretty open-ended. So it's just wide open for you guys. So the people who are tuned in live here, just go ahead and type questions in, and I'll start fielding them. And don't worry that, oh, I got to think of a really good question, because if you don't type anything, then you just sit here. So. Whatever question you're thinking of, believe me, it's better to ask it than to have me sit here and try to fill airtime. And just go ahead and you can post them right in the chat box. You don't need to do it in a separate Q&A box, because there's not that many people logged in live for these things. While you guys are thinking and writing your insightful questions, let me just also clarify that you don't need to wait when you're typing these questions and like for me to answer each one. In other words, you can go ahead and fill up the chat box with questions, and I'll pace my answers based on how quickly they fill up or not. So in other words, if I'm answering one question and you have a question that comes to your mind, either from something I said, if you want me to elaborate, or totally independent question pops into your head, you don't need to wait for me to wrap up the other one before you post it. Go ahead and post it, because if I don't know how many pending questions there are, then I don't know how long or short to make my answers. The other thing, too, is these office hours will always be on a Saturday, but the time will vary, right? So I'll do it at different times of the day with each successive week to try to cater to people who have different schedules. So it's not always going to be at 4:30 Eastern time on Saturday. It'll always be on a Saturday, but sometimes it'll be in the morning, sometimes not. Part of it is my son is in a soccer league right now that's got a few more weeks, and so they're going to be in the afternoon probably until that league is wrapped up, since I have to go to his game in the morning. Well, this is always awkward when people are logged in and aren't asking me questions. Like I said, don't be shy, because by definition, if no one else has typed in a question, your question will be the best one. I could start just pontificating on random stuff, but I'd rather you guys ask me, since you're the ones who logged in and took the time to do this. I'm curious to see what you're wondering about. To underscore that, let me just also explain that it's hard for me to know where to direct my answers or my lectures until I get some more feedback from you guys, because if you've been looking at those student introductions, the background of the people in this class is pretty varied. There's homeschooling 13-year-olds who have never looked at economics before. Maybe their parents are into the Austrians or something like that. And then there's business people in their 40s who maybe took an economics class in college, but it was all Keynesian stuff, and they so that they could start dabbling in Austrian economics and wanted to get a firm footing. So that's kind of the wide background of the people who are taking this course. All right, Peter, since you're the one who typed in that you could hear the video, let me challenge you. Why don't you go ahead and ask a question? Anything at all. All right. People are a bit gun shy. All right, well, why don't I then? Okay. Well, that's what the other people are assuming, too. So Peter says he was expecting someone else might have questions. Yeah, that's that is normally what happens. In my other classes that are the higher level ones, there's a few people who are real, you know, eager beavers, and they come in with these real particular ones, and a lot of people just log in to hear those guys and see what questions I say. So in a new class like this, sometimes we get these odd equilibria where everybody logs in because they want to hear more about the topic, but they didn't particularly have a question in mind. They assume somebody else is going to get the ball rolling. All right, well, I can just start talking about something related to course material, but like I say, the point of this is to help you guys with, you know, any particular questions you have. So while I'm talking, if something pops into your head, please, by all means, type in the chat box, and then I'll wrap up what I'm saying and come to that. So let me talk a little bit about the relationship between what we're doing in this course and Austrian economics, since there is a little bit of confusion there. So I think most of the people who signed up are familiar with Mises and Hayek and Rothbard, but some people aren't. Like I just noticed that in some of the student introductions, some people just stumbled upon Mises.org a few weeks ago. And so, or, you know, like it might be a homeschooling association where some parent posted a link to this class's description and other parents who have no familiarity with the Mises Institute logged in. So let me just give a sort of big picture overview of that to make sure everybody knows what this institutional arrangement is. So Austrian economics is named that because the founders of the school originally were from the country Austria. So the starting point was 1871. Karl Menger, a guy who was Austrian, he was actually the tutor to the crown prince of Austria, and he wrote a book called Grundsatz, which we translate as Principles of Economics, and he was one of the pioneers in what was called the Marginal Revolution. So you had the classical economists like Adam Smith, David Hume, and David Ricardo, John Stuart Mill. So those are the classical economists, and then that, and they were typically free market, talking about why tariffs were bad and things like that. And, you know, Adam Smith, of course, had his invisible hand metaphor, which said that, loosely speaking, if you just let people interact in the marketplace naturally and just let events unfold without the government trying to intervene, that even though each person may be acting in his own narrow interest or not even really taking consideration of the big picture effects of his actions, nonetheless, it seems like there's a tendency in markets for desirable social outcomes to prevail, even though no individual really is intending to help society in general. And so that's when Smith said, it's as if these events were guided by an invisible hand. All right, so that's classical school, but they actually, believe it or not, subscribe to a labor theory of value, which nowadays a lot of people attribute to Karl Marx, and that's correct to do so, but Marx got that notion from the classical economists. All right? So Karl Marx did not invent the labor theory of value, which said that the market value of goods was based on how much human labor went into it. And again, I'm simplifying with all this stuff. It would get a lot more nuanced if you actually read the original discussions. All right, so he got that from the classical economist. So in the 1870s, it was the marginal revolution that overturned that approach. And it's also been called the subjectivist revolution. So there is Karl Menger, Leon Walras, and William Stanley Jevons, who came up with a different explanation for pricing of goods in the market. And they said, no, it doesn't have to do with how much labor went into something. It has to do with your mental subjective appraisal of how much usefulness or utility you get from the good. Right, so just to give you an example, if you're walking through the forest and you stumble upon some device that was left there by aliens that can start generating whatever cupcakes, that's going to be valuable to you. And the fact that we don't know how many resources or how much labor power went into making it, because we just found it, we have no idea, that doesn't affect our ability to evaluate that thing and its usefulness or its utility to us, all right? When we value something, all we care about is going forward, how much is that thing going to help me satisfy my goals or my preferences? And you really don't care about the history of the object in order for you to assess how much money would I be willing to spend for it, for example. All right, so that's the difference between the marginal and subjectivist approach. Again, for people who are just tuning in here, let me just reiterate, I'm just going through some general big picture framing for the course here, but if you have a question, by all means, post it in the chat, and I'll wrap up my pontifications and cater to your question. I see some more people have logged in while I've been talking. All right, so again, this office hour session is for you. So if you have a question, go ahead and ask, and don't worry that, oh, man, this isn't really a good question. By definition, it is, because the point of this is for me to know what you guys are getting tripped up on or what you care about. Okay, so back to the story. That's what the marginal or subjectivist revolution was in the early 1870s. And again, Karl Menger was one of the three people historically credited with being a pioneer in this total overturning of the classical approach to what's called value theory, which means as economists, how do we go about explaining market prices? All right. So anyway, that's where they're coming from. Now, and then, like I say, Menger, with his book, started attracting disciples, you know, people who really liked the approach Karl Menger laid out, and his approach to economic questions and how he went about answering them. And so then there were other thinkers who didn't like what he was doing, you know, his critics. And so they derisive, and they were German. Right, they were members of what was called the German Historical School. And so these people derisively referred to what they called Austrian economics. Because at the time, you know, Germany was much more prestigious and had all the, you know, the best universities and whatever. And Austria was like a backwater. It was like, oh, that's where the hicks are. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but you get the idea. So for them to call it Austrian economics was a derisive term. It would be like nowadays if somebody in Washington, D.C. said to, you know, Doug French or something, like, oh, yeah, you're in a think tank down in Alabama. That's Alabama economics. You see that would be, you know, if you were among the hoity-toity and among the movers and shakers in D.C., to say somebody was from Alabama would be like a put-down. So that's kind of where this term Austrian economics came from. And then the term just stuck because just, you know, that's what it was called, and then people went on, people just were referring to that, and then after a while, now we who consider ourselves Austrian economists embrace the term with pride. So, heck yeah, I'm an Austrian. Okay, so that's where that term comes from. And it is true, of course, that Austrian economists tend to be very free market. That's not, though, the definition of Austrian economics. All right, so I should be clear about that. It's, even though it's true that if you study Austrian economics, probably you're going to end up having very, what most people would consider to be radical policy conclusions, it's not that Austrian economics starts out by assuming the government is bad or something, and then it just builds up the science. It's a logical, scientific, objective approach to economic issues, but it's that if you approach economic analysis the way most Austrians do, and you have a value system that says you like prosperity, you don't want people to be unemployed, you don't want little kids dying from malnutrition, and so on, you like peace, then with that sort of a value system coupled with the objective analysis of how the world works that Austrian economics gives you, you're probably going to end up embracing very free market policy positions. So there, because of that, it is true in modern times now, when you're looking at the spectrum of various schools of economic thought, there's the Austrian school, there's the Keynesian school after John Maynard Keynes, there's the Chicago school, which is sometimes associated with what's called monetarism. There's all kinds of different, there's Marxists and so on. There's things called neo-Ricardians, right? So there's all sorts of different schools of thought. And the point is that, yeah, from one perspective, it's true that the Austrians and, like, the Chicago school guys, the big fans of Milton Friedman, were very compatible, that we generally are against most forms of government intervention in economic affairs. So we're against tax increases, we're typically against deficit spending because it crowds out private investment, we're for low tariffs, minimum wage laws are bad because they cause unemployment, rent control is bad because it causes shortages of apartments, stuff like that. But actually Chicago School of Economics is analytically different from the Austrians. Right, they approach economics from a different perspective. It's just that their policy conclusions on many issues happen to be similar, the one glaring exception being when it comes to monetary policy. That typically Chicago School economists would say things that were a lot different from what Austrians would say. All right. In this course, the principles of economics that I'm teaching you guys, and that's based on my textbook, Lessons for the Young Economist, it's not... I kept things at such a level of generality that if you're a Chicago school economist or an Austrian, you probably would agree with everything I say in the book. All right, the Chicago school guys might not agree with the last chapter of the book that's on the business cycle, but an Austrian would agree with just about everything. Because I'm an Austrian, so if I'm boiling down my approach into basic principles, I'm going to agree with everything that I believe. So that's the way that works, if that makes sense to you. So I'm just trying to explain what you guys are getting from me in this course is not really an intro to Austrian economics. This is more general. This is like an intro to what you could call free market economics. And by calling it free market economics, I don't mean to say that we start out assuming the free market is the answer we want, and then how do we get there? All I'm trying to do, though, is to let people know that this course is going to end up leading to conclusions that say the free market is the best way to arrange social affairs, given that you have a normal value system and want to help poor people and don't want there to be massive unemployment and stuff like that. whereas other principles of economics courses, like if you went to a standard college somewhere and just took their Econ 101 or Econ 201, they would teach you all kinds of stuff about the proper role for government in fixing what they would call market failures. And I don't think that that's very good analysis. So that's, you know, you're not going to get that kind of stuff in this course. So that's why I try to clarify by saying it's a free market economics intro. Okay, we've got some questions. And again, more people are trickling in here as the minutes tick by. So let me just again state, by all means, you got a question pops in your head, just type it out. You don't need to wait for me to finish, and then I'll steer the discussion to answer your question. Okay. So Alex says, do we study Menger or already studying Menger? I think he means in this course. No. The quick answer is no. I'm just giving you guys sort of here historical background in case some people here don't really know what that term Austrian economics even means and how does it relate to other terms they might hear. So no, we're not going to do any sort of historical, you know, history of economics discussion in this course in terms of the actual material that I'm going to lecture on Wednesdays or that you might have to be tested on. I'm just giving you a little of the background there. Alex then says, isn't Austrian economics scoffed at just for being outside the educational norm, in other words, outside of elementary, high school, university, as far as I'm aware? Yes. Yeah, that's a good point. I should clarify. So Austrian economics originally was scoffed at by the German historical school. Then it did become quite respectable, you know, even among mainstream economists. So Ludwig von Mises, early in his career, was a very respected economist, you know, particularly a monetary theorist. You know, his work, which we now translate as the theory of money and credit, I mean, it's not like I read German and I went back to the journals of the day and looked at the book reviews or whatever, but I mean, it's, my sense is that Mises was a well-respected member among his colleagues in his younger days. And then what ended up happening is, as governments grew, the economics profession became more interventionist. And I'm not saying one caused the other or vice versa. I probably actually, in practice, it was more of a mutually reinforcing trend. But the point is, especially after the Great Depression, people like Mises and Hayek were looked at by most of the top economists as dinosaurs. You know, like, oh yeah, you guys were good in your day, and you made some decent insights into capital structure and how the business cycle works and stuff like that, but, you know, your dogmatic, laissez-faire attitudes are just obsolete at this point. The 1930s showed us that sitting back and doing nothing is a disaster, or can be, if the situation is right, and it showed us the need for massive government intervention if the free market economy gets stuck in a rut. And so since you guys, you Austrians, are incapable of dealing with situations like that, you know, history has moved on. Economic science has progressed past where you guys are, and you refuse to update because of your rigid political views, and so, you know, we no longer take you seriously. The other thing is Austrian economics is not very mathematical, right? So if you just look through the classic texts in Austrian economics, or even go to Mises University at the Mises Institute that occurs in late July every year, where we take a week and just go through an intro to Austrian economics, and then some applications later on in the week, you'll see we don't put up a bunch of equations or even graphs to get across the core of Austrian economics, which is totally different from regular mainstream economics that you would get in a standard college course, or especially if you wanted to grad school. So that's another reason that modern, you know, economists who teach at Harvard and Yale and MIT, but even at other mid-tier universities would say those Austrians, they're obsolete because they're not even mathematical anymore. You know, economics has gotten much more precise and scientific and rigorous since the 1930s, and yet these Austrians are still writing in words. I mean, what the heck is that? And that, just to give you an anecdote, that happened when I was in grad school. I was working on a paper for what was called the Austrian Colloquium, which was a weekly meeting of Austrian economists to discuss a paper. You know, somebody would come and present a paper each week. And so I was a grad student at New York University, which is a very mathematical program. And NYU happened to be where the Austrian Colloquium was held, because Israel Kirzner taught there, and Mario Rizzo, and now David Harper. And those guys are big fans of the Austrian school. And of course, Mises historically had taught at NYU, too. All right, so they would have this thing. So anyway, I'm sitting in the computer lab working on my paper that, like, the next week I was going to present at the Austrian Colloquium. You know, I was going to be a grad student presenting at this colloquium where I would attend each week, you know, in the audience. So, you know, I'm really putting myself into this paper. I want to do a good job and everything. And the guy, a fellow student getting a PhD with me in my program, you know, the NYU doctoral program for economics, he was this guy from Turkey who was a math whiz, and he's like, "What are you working on there?" And so I told him, he's looking through it, and he was just laughing at, you know, he wasn't trying to be a jerk, but he was just like, "Well, you Austrians, it's just cut and paste, isn't it?" And what he's referring to is, it was just all words, and there were a lot of block quotes. You know how you put a big long quotation from some other book into your paper, and you know shrink the font and shrink the margins to set it apart from the main text. And he's just, you know, flipping through, and he's like, "Where are the equations? This is just, it's like a book report. What the heck is this?" You know, he thought it was for English class or something, because for him, an economic paper is a mathematical model, and it's mostly a bunch of equations with just some words to explain, you know, the motivation behind the equations. But, you know, the work of the analysis is in cranking out the equilibrium of the model. And then, you know, there's not many words at all. And you certainly wouldn't go quote a bunch of things from some other person's words and put it in your paper. What the heck is that? So yes, Alex, you're totally right. Modern PhD economists, for the most part, would either be outright hostile to Austrian economics, thinking it was totally obscure. And you could just see the treatment of Ron Paul and his favoring of the gold standard by most economists. I mean, they think it's laughable. You know, they think it's like analogous to a six-day creationist, you know, someone who thinks that evolution is, that the theory of evolution is wrong, and that the Genesis biblical account is literally true. The way modern biologists think of that, and people who espouse that, that's almost like the way modern economists at Harvard and Yale and MIT think of the economists associated with the Mises Institute. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but not much. Okay. And by the way, I'm not there trying to say I agree with the Darwinist, you know, dismissal of that. So I'm just trying to say, I'm sure whatever your views are on the evolution debate, you've seen the attitude of, "Oh my gosh, can you believe these idiots who ignore modern science?" I'm saying that attitude is about what economists at Ivy League schools think of when they think of some Austrian economist saying, "Oh, the gold standard was a lot better than having fiat central banking." They would think, "You are crazy. You have no idea of what the profession has learned in the last 80 years. You know, just get out of here, you charlatan." That's what they would think, most of them. Okay, let's see. Alex says that it's scientific using logic, not measurement, from what the first four chapters say, no? Okay, so let me just rearrange your question, Alex, to make sure I understand it. I think what you're saying is Austrian economics is scientific. It's just the Austrians, it's not scientific in the same way that physics or chemistry are scientific. But Austrian economics is scientific according to the methodological approach that Mises and Rothbard think is appropriate for a social science like economics. So if that's what you're saying, then yes. And again, just to clarify, in the textbook, the principle or Lessons for the Young Economist, again, I'm not there describing Austrian economics per se. I'm just trying to be broader and talk about economics, but it is true that what I say there is, anything I say in there is consistent with Austrian economics, put it that way. But I was trying to be Big Ten and say stuff that a lot of economists would agree with, not just Austrians. So you're right, Alex. The people who criticize, you know, the guys at Harvard or whatever who would look down their noses at Austrian economics and say, oh, you guys are unscientific because you don't have mathematical models and you don't go make predictions and then go look at the data sets and see how well your predictions stand up. Somebody like Mises would say, you're right, we don't do that, but that doesn't mean we're unscientific. It means we're actually being better scientists because we understand the nature of our discipline. It's you who are actually being a bad scientist because you're just aping the methods of the physicists, not realizing that those methods are inappropriate for what we're trying to study here. It's kind of like, Mises and especially, well, Hayek more than Mises, but Hayek a lot of times, you know, he's got some passages where he is very skeptical about the abilities of human reason. And so if you read those passages in isolation, you might think that Hayek was, you know, anti-rational or something. And that's not true at all. Hayek himself was a very rational person. He was very smart and logical and so forth, and of course he understood the great benefits of the natural sciences and stuff like that, and he understood the benefits of the Age of Enlightenment for civilization and human culture and all that stuff. But his point was there was an arrogance that really flourished in the 20th century among the intelligentsia where these reformers thought that they would just look at social institutions, spend some time pondering it, and if they couldn't they couldn't come up with a good reason for why we have private property rights, if it just seemed like it was a historical anachronism, it's just this thing that privileges the rich people, and that's stupid. Why don't we just get rid of that and using our heads, invent some whole new system and replace it at gunpoint? And Hayek was, you know, chastising those people for being way too arrogant and having way too much confidence in the ability of their reason to just start from scratch and design a whole new society. So his point in saying that wasn't to denigrate human reason and to just be like a superstitious worshiper of the past. His point was more that the human mind actually is limited, and the reason we have certain traditions and institutions and cultural norms that have been, you know, tweaked over the centuries and that we've inherited, and that's what prevails right now and is the status quo, it's because there's a lot of things that you probably aren't even thinking of. And so just because you look around and you say, well, why is it considered weird to marry your sister? That's dumb. I can't think of any good reason for that, so let's get rid of that, you know, stuff like that. Or why wouldn't you have cannibalism? I don't see anything wrong with that. Or why wouldn't you have socialism? I don't see anything wrong with that. Or why do we have money? That's dumb. You see, that Hayek's point was, no, there's, you know, we can't just assume we can think about something for 20 minutes and then figure it all out and replace it with something we invent off the top of our heads if it seems like the latter thing would be better to us, that we need to be very cautious before we start upending the institutions of society. And so, in a sense, Hayek is being far more rational or reasonable with that skepticism. And but yet, you know, a critic might paint that as saying, oh, Hayek is anti-reason, and he's a, you know, a whim worshiper or something, when that's not true at all. So the same, so you're right, Alex, the, I would say the Austrians are actually more scientific than the mainstream, but it's a more nuanced notion of what scientific means in the context of economics. Okay, George Smith says, to your knowledge, did any mathematical economist predict the crisis? Yeah. So let me be clear on that. The it's not right when people say, as I see them often say, oh, only the Austrians predicted this, and all you Keynesians are a bunch of idiots because we called it and you didn't, so you should shut up. I mean, I'm being hostile, but that I've seen people say stuff like that. So, for example, Paul Krugman predicted the crisis. Well, I don't know if he predicted the crisis, but he said there was a housing bubble for sure earlier than I did, for example. All right, so if I'm admitting that Krugman was better on that than I was, you know, that's a big concession on my part. I'm only saying that because intellectual honesty compels me to. Nouriel Roubini also had some remarks at various economics conferences where people at the time thought he was nuts. And if you go back and look at what he said, it was shockingly good in terms of the specificity of his predictions about, you know, what was going to happen and how the credit markets were going to seize up and the downturn and the subprime and housing and da-da-da-da-da. So, like, in the same ballpark as the specificity of what Peter Schiff said. Whereas Krugman, I don't think he got very specific. I think he was just like, in 2005 and 2006, was saying there was a big housing bubble. But, I mean, Roubini, if you see some of the stuff he said, it was really pretty precise. He wasn't just making generic statements like housing is overvalued. He was making specific predictions about which sectors were going to start going down first and in which order and stuff like that. So George, to answer your question, it's not true to say just the Austrians saw this crisis coming. Now, of course, I would think that the Austrian diagnosis was more accurate, right? So Roubini thought there was a problem because of deregulation. And then once the crisis struck, Roubini thought we needed massive government deficits to fix the problem, right? So obviously, you know, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying Krugman and Roubini were as good economists as Peter Schiff was or Ron Paul in terms of assessing the situation. But my point is just on the raw criterion of before the crisis was obvious, were the Austrians the only economists who were warning that something bad was about to hit us? The answer is no, that Paul Krugman and Roubini can correctly claim that they also were warning that a crisis was upon us before it was common knowledge. You're right, though, George. Bernanke was totally off. If you guys go look, if you've never seen it, it's pretty funny. If you go to YouTube and type in Bernanke was wrong, you should be able to find it. Should be one of the top hits. There's like a 6 or 7 minute compilation of Bernanke quotes from back before he was even the Fed chair. And they start like, I think, in 2005, something like that. And it just goes through and just step by step at every stage of the crisis, Bernanke was totally wrong. So, you know, in the midst of the housing boom, he's on CNBC saying there is no housing boom. Then once it's clear that the subprime sector is imploding, Bernanke's on CNBC saying this is going to be contained in the subprime. It won't spread to the rest of the economy. Then once it's spreading to the rest of the economy, Bernanke's like testifying before Congress saying, yes, the economy's slowing down, but we think that by 2008, you know, we're going to have an above average year of growth and this will be behind us. And of course, that's the opposite of what happened. And so the point is, every step of the way, he's totally wrong. So that's kind of funny. You know, as I mentioned, when I first saw that video, and this is when they reappointed Bernanke as the Fed chair, And I was saying, you know, what more would Bernanke have to do to show he doesn't know what the heck he's talking about? It'd be hard for you to invent a fictional economist who could have been more wrong systematically at every stage. You know, it's not just like, oh, he missed it in the beginning, but then once he got corrected, then he was spot on. No, every stage. You know, before the crisis set in, going into it, during it, and then as we start emerging, apparently, he's totally wrong about everything he was saying. So my point was just, what would you have to do to not get reappointed as Fed chair? So, anyway. Well, we got about 10 more minutes. And I think I've answered all of the questions that have been posted thus far. So, George Smith says, have you seen Bernanke's videos at GWU? No. Are you referring, George, to the recent where Bernanke, like, literally taught some courses or gave some lectures to college students? Yeah. So for those who don't know what George is talking about, was it at George Washington University? George, is that where he was? Yeah. Okay, so Bernanke, this was like in February or March or something, I'm not sure when, but he went and actually, you know, it's kind of odd that as a sitting Fed chief, Bernanke's giving lectures. But anyway, he did that, and I don't know, you know, who knows. And my guess is he did it to try to rehabilitate his image and the image of the Fed chief, because especially for those of you who are younger, you might not realize this, but before Bernanke, the Federal Reserve chair was just like revered as almost a superhuman institution. You know, like Alan Greenspan, and he later admitted that he would do this on purpose. I mean, this is kind of funny. Like, you know, if you're a magician, you're not supposed to reveal your tricks or the secret behind your tricks, and that's kind of what Greenspan did after the fact. But he would go to these press conferences, or not press, but congressional hearings and stuff, and read statements that, you know, he would talk for 30 seconds and then stop, and he would not have actually uttered a single coherent statement. Like, he would talk, and it would sound like he was saying something, but then when he was done, you'd realize he said absolutely nothing. It was brilliant in terms of what it was. And he did it on purpose because, and like I said, I'm not just being a conspiracy theorist. He admitted this with, I forget who it was, but like on one of those shows, like 2020 or something, I don't remember which show it was, afterward, they showed Alan Greenspan, who now was retired, you know, he was no longer the Fed chair, they would show him some of the clips from his earlier testimony when he was Fed chair, where he's just saying gobbledygook, and he kind of chuckled, like, you know, and admitted that, oh yeah, that was a good one, wasn't it? And so his point was, he didn't want to rattle the markets. Like, so if he said, oh, I think gold is overpriced, well, then that would cause gold to crash. Or if he said, I think housing is overpriced, that would cause housing to crash. You know what I mean? So the point was, he didn't want to say anything. But yet, he wanted to reassure the markets that he was a genius and he was in control and he knew what was going on. He was taking care of them. So he would use all these big words and everything and his jargon to make it look like, don't worry, the adults are in charge here. We're taking care of the economy. So, I mean, it was really a match for performance. But the point is, you wouldn't, it wasn't like late-night comedians were making fun of Alan Greenspan. Because, first of all, the public really didn't know much about him. Secondly, Fed policy was extremely boring. Who the heck cares about Fed? I don't want to talk about that. That makes my head hurt. That was like in college when we were doing the, you know, the bank lends $100,000 and then $90,000 gets deposited and this, oh man, that's going to give me a headache. I don't even think about that. Right? That was the attitude. The Fed was kind of not even an issue. Whereas now, because of Ron Paul and, you know, the bailouts and everything like that, I mean, the Fed is now a hot button issue and people are debating it, and Ben Bernanke is a laughingstock among certain segments of the public. Like that YouTube video with the two bears, you know, talking about the Bernanke. I mean, that would have been inconceivable 8 years ago. besides the fact that not as many people would use YouTube, but that the idea that a video could go viral making fun of the Fed chair, that would you know, it would be like picking on an undersecretary of the FTC or something, like, right? Who the heck cares? That's not funny. You know, yeah, let's make fun of the Secret Service and the Colombian prostitutes, ha ha ha, but nobody cares about the FTC. And so that's kind of the way the Fed used to be, but now the Fed is a big deal. And so anyway, Bernanke, I think in an effort to rehabilitate his reputation and to restore some prestige and some credibility to the Fed as an institution, gave some lecture at George Washington University recently. And so George Smith, to answer your question, I didn't see the actual lectures, but I did read about one of them where he, I think the first one, where he, you know, goes out of his way to take pot shots at the gold standard. And I, in a perfect world, I would have had more time to do like a Mises.org article going through what Bernanke said, but I just didn't have time. So George then follows up. Everything you rebutted, so George is talking to me, everything you rebutted in the Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression and the New Deal, that's a book I wrote, Bernanke proclaimed as true. For example, that the gold standard caused the depression, that there wasn't enough gold, that Andrew Mellon typified the Hoover response, liquidationist, and so on. George, really? He said that Hoover was a liquidationist and quoted from Mellon? That's pretty underhanded if he did that, or just completely ignorant. So let me just talk a little bit about that. He quoted Mellon, wow. So for those who don't know, Andrew Mellon was the Treasury Secretary for, I guess it was three administrations. So for the Warren G. Harding, who died in office he wasn't in office very long. Then Calvin Coolidge, who was in office for most of the 1920s. And then Herbert Hoover, at least for, I don't think Mellon was Hoover's Treasury Secretary for the whole first term. I think he either resigned or was fired or something at some point through it. But in any event, Andrew Mellon was the Treasury Secretary for most of the post-World War I period there up until the Great Depression. And Mellon was a major supply sider in today's terminology, that he, coming out of World War I, we had very high marginal tax rates. I want to say like 77%, something like that. I would have to go look at the exact number. So, the federal income tax, the rate on the top bracket was ridiculously high, like in the 70s. And so under Mellon, they cut those tax rates dramatically during the 20s. And Mellon's arguments were very much like what Arthur Laffer would say later, going into the Reagan years, that Mellon was saying with these high rates, there's no incentive for people to put their to work in taxable areas. And so rich people just have all their wealth locked up in tax-free government bonds. And so that's not good for investment and economic growth. You want rich entrepreneurs out there creating new businesses and so on and doing things that cause taxable income, but they're not going to do that if the government's getting whatever it was, 77 cents on the dollar. So if we bring down those top rates, that will give people an incentive to go out and earn more, and the tax base will grow, and in fact, we might actually see revenue go up because the tax base will grow more than we're cutting the rates of taxation. So that was what Mellon pushed through, and you can argue about what caused what, but it's clear that, or it's undeniable that by the end of the 1920s, the federal government was taking a lot more tax revenue than it was in the early 20s. Okay, so then anyway, there's this famous passage in Herbert Hoover's autobiography, he wrote some memoirs looking back on his career, and of course he spent a lot of time talking about the Great Depression, since Hoover was in office from 28 to 32. And remember the historical rap against Hoover was that he sat back and did nothing, and he didn't care enough about poor people, and it was on his watch that the nation plunged into the Great Depression. And then, thank goodness, FDR came in and was elected in, you know, late 1932, comes into office in 33, and implements the New Deal and saves America from the Depression. Right, that's the standard historical treatment of these issues. That's what, if you went to a U.S. school growing up, that's what you were taught. That's what I was taught by my history teachers. All right, so Hoover, as you can imagine, in his autobiographical memoirs, doesn't like that view of things. And so to try to show the reader that he, Hoover, was a nice guy and was an interventionist too, and was doing what he could as president to help poor people and to fix the economy, he was trying to show that he ignored the advice of his Treasury Secretary Mellon. So Hoover's got this quote, you know, so Hoover's talking about how, yep, the stock market crashed in, October of 1929, and so then we have a big, you know, big powwow. It's me, the president, and all of my top advisors, and we're trying to figure out what to do. And so as Hoover tells the story, Andrew Mellon, his Treasury Secretary, says, "We don't do anything, sir. We sit back and we just let the market blow itself out. We liquidate labor, we liquidate stocks, we liquidate farmland. Just, you know, we had this big unsustainable boom, and the only way to fix things is to let everything crash and find its natural bottom, and then it will recover." And we actually, you know, have historical evidence that this works, and then Mellon apparently pointed back to an earlier depression from, I think, I forget which one he pointed, I think it was like from the 1890s or something, saying, you know, back then there was a really bad depression too, but you know what, the federal government didn't do a thing, and we hit rock bottom pretty soon, and boom, bounce right back, that's what we should do. And so now as Hoover is telling the story, he then tells the reader, but I and some of my other advisors completely disagreed with Mellon. And so we didn't do that. Instead, we engaged in a massive expansion of federal activity, more than has ever been seen in the peacetime history of the Republic, blah, 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 blah. So what's astonishing is now people who want to make fun of, like, the Austrian liquidationist program call that a Herbert Hoover response, and they will quote and say, ah, see, as Herbert Hoover's own Treasury Secretary described it, what they were going to do was liquidate labor, liquidate real estate, liquidate da da da. I mean, so that is just about a lie. You know what I mean? So either it's ignorance or a lie to say that Herbert Hoover was a liquidationist and then quote from the views of his Treasury Secretary, because the only evidence we have of that that's what Mellon's views were. I mean, Mellon didn't ever say that publicly. All we have is Herbert Hoover, his version of things written down years later, and the whole point was Hoover to say, I didn't do that. He's trying to get sympathy from the reader by saying, look at the nut job views of my Treasury Secretary. Aren't you glad we didn't do that in my administration? And also, too, you know, if you look at the record, Hoover didn't do that stuff in his administration. So it's not just taking his word against Mellon. You can go look at the numbers and look what happened with spending and so forth and the types of things that the government did. The Hoover administration was not at all a laissez-faire liquidationist administration. So anyway. Okay, and then George gives us a link. Okay, well, that's the time we got for today. Thank you. Well, let's see. Peter has one more question here, and since I didn't start until a few minutes later, I'll go ahead and go a few minutes over. So I'll answer Peter's question here. No, no problem, Peter. I'll answer Peter's question, and then we'll wrap up this session. So Peter says, what exactly are trade-offs and opportunity costs? Are they the same thing, or what's the difference? I'm going to actually come back to this at the start of Lecture 2 on this coming Wednesday, because I didn't get to this section, you know, at the end of Lecture 1, and I realized that I need to talk about costs. So I'm not going to go through the full discussion right now, but let me just explain what those are. Okay, so a trade-off, so they're, the concepts aren't identical, Peter, but they're closely related. So a trade-off means whenever you try to achieve something in one dimension, that's going to hurt you in another dimension. Right? So to say, hey, there's always trade-offs, kind of what that means is, you know, if you're, the more you're trying to achieve one type of thing, you're going to be worse off on some other margin. Okay, whereas opportunity cost is a little bit more specific. Opportunity cost is saying when you take an action, what is the value to you of the next best thing that you gave up because you took the action? And that's what the opportunity cost of your decision is. Okay, so because there are trade-offs, you know that there's going to be an opportunity cost. If that makes sense. But they're technically not exactly the same thing. But like I say, I will talk more about what an opportunity cost is next week at the start of lecture two, because that's something I didn't get to in lecture one. That's a pretty important topic. Okay, guys, thanks for tuning in, and I will see you, or you will see me, I guess, on Wednesday. And remember, if you're taking the class for credit, that you need to do the quiz one, which has been posted and will be open through Thursday.